Mary, Mary, quite contrary. How does your garden grow? Nowadays it's kind of hard to say. Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the false story. Without you, there's no false story. So I thank you. As for the question as to how does your garden grow, that's what we're going to talk about today. And in a moment, we're going to explain how this show came about. And a bit later on, we're also going to talk about what's swimming nowadays or not swimming in the waters of our region. The fishing industry has changed, and man, that's putting it mildly. Now, as to our topic today, it goes back to a conversation we had recently about farmers markets in our region. And if you missed that conversation, you can stream the program online at WSHU.org, or you can download it as a podcast. But during that show, we were talking about what's growing, what's not growing, coming in early, coming in late. And because so many of you contacted us, we thought we should delve into this a little bit more. Now, to start us off on our conversation today, we're calling on Carissa Battle. Carissa is an ecologist and is the founding director of the Community Greenways Collaborative. Carissa, nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Before we get going, just give us the elevator pitch about the Community Greenways Collaborative. When did you start it? Where are you based out of?
So I'm based out of the Catskill Mountains in New York. I'm originally from Queens. But I started in about 2012, getting to know a lot of the different organizations in the region and realizing that New York had an incredible potential for community science to really tackle important topics such as climate change and urbanization, because there's a fantastic gradient. And so Community Greenways is helping to catalyze social and ecological networked initiatives and has now expanded across the state with certain initiatives.
Okay, thanks for that. Now, I think it's important to point out right at the beginning that you are a phenologist. I think our listeners are some pretty smart cookies, but just in case, what's a phenologist?
So a phenologist, the word phenology, it sounds like a pretty technical term, but it actually has quite a beautiful meaning. So pheno, the Latin root pheno, is to show or to bring to light or to appear. And so phenology refers to the timing of recurring life cycle events in the natural world. So for plants, that would be, you know, budding, flowering, fruiting. For animals, that could be migrating, egg laying, hatching, and so forth.
All right, so that brings us to the meat of our program, the main point, which farmers and gardeners tell me they've known about for a long time now, and it's about time we in the media got caught up with this. So with your knowledge and background, are crops and plants coming in at different times nowadays, and if they are, why, and is there a direct link to climate change and the climate crisis?
Yes, well, absolutely. There is a direct link. So, you know, phenology is one of the main quantifiable biological indicators of climate change. So, in other words, we know what we know in part because there are these historic data sets that have been collected in the past, often by amateur naturalists or farmers. And then, you know, we obviously have modern data to compare it to, and we can see that there is a pretty drastic change in the last 50 years, particularly. You know, we're looking at a kind of average across global species of about, 10 days or so over the last 50 years. But I and some colleagues also have recently worked with a data set previously undigitized in New York State from the early 1800s that we have quite a lot of data looking at farming. So apple blossoms when people were haying their fields and so forth. And it's this incredibly rich trove of information to actually even get more information. So we're working on that now. We started with the wild plants, native plants in New York State, and we'll move toward the agriculture. But from what we can see right now, there's pretty intense changes over the last couple of centuries, and like I said, markedly over the last 50 years.
Carissa, are there any specific fruits or vegetables that you can cite? Someone said the other week that beans aren't growing. And then someone complained to me the other day that some apples he had recently had no taste. And he was wondering if that was because of what we're talking about.
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, it's complex because there's, of course, the effects when you're talking about plants that have fruit. They need to be pollinated effectively. So in some ways, you know, it's difficult to tease out exactly what is directly related to temperature and, you know, what also might be related to, you know, where someone is and whether their crops or their gardens or farms are receiving enough pollination and things like that. And so, but in general, you know, there are a lot of great examples of direct impacts, like 2012, for example, apple crops were completely decimated in New York. And that was directly because there was such warm weather early in the season that the apples blossomed early, and then there was a hard frost that killed all the blossoms. And when I went back to look at this historic record in New York from the earlier part of the 1800s, you know, I could see that apples really never were flowering before mid-May or late May, and that's no longer the case. So, you know, so some species are very linked to temperature, and some crops are linked to temperature, and so they respond. If you have a handful of warm days in a row, they suddenly think, okay, it's time to go, it's spring.
Yeah.
And then they start to blossom, and then, but, you know, climate patterns are so erratic now that you can't predict when there's going to be a hard frost. And so, you know, farmers are as they always have been, in, you know, a tricky spot, gambling with the weather, but it's obviously becoming more and more of a gamble as the climate becomes more and more erratic.
Carissa, you mentioned pollination, and I want to bring in a guest for a few minutes to join us, because as you alluded to, for a number of years, we've been hearing reports about the impact we've had on bees and pollination with what we've done to the environment and now climate change. We don't have the time, even though it's an hour-long program, we don't have the time to go into all the details, but we do have Debbie Klugers joining us, and Debbie is the owner of Bonac Bees, to give us an overview. Hey, Debbie, how are you?
Hey, I'm pretty good. How are you today?
We're great, thank you, and I appreciate you coming on with us, and with the limited time we have, how are the bees nowadays?
Well, in America, the bees are not doing very well. Globally, the bees are doing better. We've got a major problem. We all hear about the bees' decline, but it's really, they're increasing throughout the world, but America is experiencing, since the 1950s, a decline in our honeybee population from about 6 million colonies to, right now, we are under 3 million. And we experienced the worst die-off last winter ever recorded. So we have a major issue here in America, and the how that will pan out could be increased cost of food, decreased availability, and a very boring food supply, because as your other guest was discussing, we need bees and other pollinators to pollinate our food.
Carissa, with what Debbie was saying, would you attribute the decline, and I believe she said it was about a 50% decline in the United States, is that from what we've done to the environment, or is that from climate change?
Well, it's from all of the above.
Okay. check D, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You know, there is what we call sort of synergistic effects. So the climate changing adds a stress. Invasive species, so the honeybees particularly, experience this mite, which is a pathogen, and then pesticides. So all of these stressors kind of combine, basically, and begin to weaken certain species. And that's the case not just for honeybees, but for all wild species. And wild bees, which do quite a lot of the pollination as well, even in agriculture, they are also experiencing a pretty dramatic decline. That's estimated at about 23%.
Hmm. Krissa, I have to take a short break. Hold on one second, please.
Right.
We'll catch up on the other side of the break. Debbie Klugers is the owner of Bonac Bees. And Debbie, I wanted to ask you, and I know I only have you for a short time. The change you talked about, the decrease of 50% of the population in the United States, is a staggering one. What do you attribute that to?
Well, if we look at the timing, in the 1950s is when the bee crash started to occur. So what happened back then? The Green Revolution, the new pesticides, you know, the DDTs and all that. And there's just something different that we're doing or that we're not doing here in America that the rest of the world is not experiencing what we are experiencing. So, you know, we've got the invasive species, the mites and the beetles that are harming the bees globally. We've got a lack of forage, you know, which should be something with development and land use practices that's decreasing. But there's something in America that's going on that's really troubling to me. Too much. The land is not being managed to support the ecosystem that is going to provide us not only our food, but the pollinators cause the plants to do their own reproduction. So we could be losing not only our food supply, but our native vegetation, and you know, which supports our wildlife. So there's a lot of things in play here. And I don't want to be waiting and be the last country to the table that actually understands what's going on with the problem with the honeybees. And it's only important if your listeners eat food or if they know people who eat food. Otherwise, we don't have a problem.
I like to eat food, and it's important to me. Debbie, I only have you for another minute. So tell us, what should we do right away to correct this problem?
I think the easiest thing that everybody could do is plant some flowering trees. Trees and bushes give the biggest bang for the buck for the pollinators, not only honeybees, but all species that require the nectar and the pollen. So one tree can give you as much forage as a whole acre of wildflowers. So go ahead and plant that linden tree, plant some privet, plant some buttonbush, some holly, some even the winged sumac, the wild species that are less expensive to buy at your nursery. You can the winged sumac, the honeybees absolutely love it. So support your beekeepers and your farmers, and try to use just be less destructive to the environment. Use alternatives to pesticides. Plenty of things that we can do. Let the clover grow in the grass. Clover and dandelions are the first food for the bees and the pollinators. So simple things, inexpensive things. Don't shear the privet until it's done flowering. It's a few weeks. You just need to wait to get that beautiful sheared hedge. Just let the beautiful white privet flowers give the nectar to the pollinators, and then share the privet, and it would make a huge difference for the bees and other pollinators.
Debbie, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Please come back in the future for a longer discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the invite. It's a really important topic.
Thanks, Debbie. Debbie Klugers, owner of Bonac Bees. Thanks, Debbie. Be good. Krissa is still with us. Krissa Battle. Yeah. Ecologist, founding director of the Community Greenways Collaborative. And we are also being joined by Nikki Auger, who is the vineyard manager and winemaker at Taylor Brook Winery in Woodstock, Connecticut. And Charles Massoud is with us also. He is the president and an owner of Pominac Vineyards and of Palmer Vineyards. It's two of the oldest wineries on the North Fork of the island. Nikki, Charles, thank you for joining the conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Nikki, how are your grapes nowadays? I mean, are you seeing a difference in quality, quantity, coming in at different times?
You know, we are. I think that one of the biggest changes we've noticed is the increase in unpredictable weather. And you might be saying we are New Englanders, we're used to that. But it really has been changing. This year in particular, we suffered from winter injury, which dramatically lowered our yields. And what happened was last fall, it just didn't get cold in the sort of way that it was supposed to. The vines will naturally hibernate in the winter and self-protect. But last year it rained and it was warmer, so the tissue froze before the plant had a chance to properly shut down. And as a result, we're seeing that in our harvest with this year with much lower yields. So that's one thing that happened this year.
Charles, are I'm sorry, Charles, are you finding the same thing on the island?
Actually, no. I'm sorry to hear what happened in New England, but out here on Long Island, we are having a wonderful harvest. It's high quality and high quantity. But confirming what she says, the weather changes all the time here. We started here in 1983, and every year we say the weather this year is different. It's no different this year. But we've had 3 years, 13, 14, 15, which were amazing quality, then followed by three bad years, and now we're back to a very good high-quality season. So we're very much dependent on the weather. What does change, however, is when we compare to the 80s and the 90s, we used to harvest would begin around Columbus Day in October. Now we're harvesting closer to mid-September. So
wow.
The harvest has advanced by a full month in the span of 20, 25 years.
A full month? I didn't realize that. I knew it had changed, but I thought it was a matter of a week, week and a half. I didn't realize it was 4 weeks.
Yeah, you know, we are just as surprised as anybody. And, you know, our summers are getting warmer, which in our case is a good thing for in the meantime, you know, for the time being, a warmer summer creates more riper fruit. But long-term is a problem if that trend continues.
Carissa Battle, this kind of fits in exactly with what you and I were talking about at the beginning of the program. Carissa, are you there? You know, I'm telling you that we just have to go and we have to pay our phone bills nowadays. We're going to try to get Carissa back in just a minute. Oh, Carissa, are you there? All right, we'll get her back in a little bit from now. Nikki, is there anything... I have spoken to winery owners in the past, and they tell me that it's always difficult. They try to plan. They try to do the right things. But someone told me, and this goes back about 20 or 30 years ago, I'll never forget, he said, I do all the best planning in the world that I can, and in the end, it's all a crapshoot. And he goes, but you have to try. Is that what you deal with all the time? Now you have climate changes thrown in on top of this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a plan B and a plan C for every step of the season because, you know, I learned that early. You have one plan and it gets thrown out the window, and you really do have to evaluate the present moment and sort of be ready for anything, especially this time of year. The other thing we've noticed, not this season, as my colleague mentioned, it has been warm and sunny and beautiful, ripening, but the increase of threats of hurricanes. So the hurricane season coincides with harvest season. So you always have one eye on the weather, watching those hurricanes and getting ready. If you had to pick early, you had to pick early. That happened to us a couple years ago. The fruit wasn't as ripe as we wanted it, but there was just that hurricane threat, so we had to make that decision. So, you know, that comes up more and more.
And before I get back to Charles, he was saying that they are harvesting now a month earlier compared to what they did years ago. Are you finding the same in Connecticut?
Yes.
A full month earlier.
And this is a family business, so this is only the third harvest that I'm running by myself. But my father and some of my more senior staff all remember saying, like, yeah, we never started harvesting, or we would finish at the end of October, and that is just not the case now. We're all in by the first week of October at the latest, and much, you know, we're going to be done this week.
Carissa, are you back with us?
I am. Sorry, dropped out for a minute.
Nope, no problem. Thanks for coming back. I was just remarking that this goes back to what Charles and Nikki are talking about. This goes back to what you and I were talking about at the very beginning of the program, that it's, but in some ways, and I was just telling Charles, I was surprised by the 4 weeks. I had heard that it had changed, and I thought it would be a week and a half, but it seems to be happening so much faster nowadays.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And some of the research I'm doing, I'm seeing changes in certain species in the 3 to 4 week range from these historic data sets. And, you know, it's alarming because there's timing is everything. And, you know, when species are interacting, a big change of that magnitude can have cascading ecological impacts that, you know, obviously can affect, you know, economics, tourism, you know, human health, food security, and it's hard to know exactly how species are responding. So, you know, knowing that grapes are a full month ahead is really interesting.
Charles, how's the quality of your grapes?
You know, as I like to say, we're partners with Mother Nature, but we are the junior partner. And therefore, it really depends on how the summer unfolds. This year, as we've discussed, it's been sunny and dry, not too warm. Too warm is not good because the vine stops producing sugar. So the weather has been superb for us. And what we like, the vines like the same kind of weather. And therefore, the ripeness is excellent. We're looking at a really very high-quality vintage, which we've been really waiting for, because the last 3 years, as my colleague said, we've had these tropical storms that would swing by, and we get a lot of humidity, which promotes sour rot. But this year, it's been dry. Luckily, we avoided the tropical storms, and it looks like we'll finish the harvest before any tropical storm comes nearby. So it's looking very good. We're very pleased with the outcome this year. So near term, we're going to be benefiting from the warming trend. I hate to say that. But long-term, you know, those of us who want to make a bad joke here, they say we're going to have waterfront property where we are.
Mm-hmm. Nikki, are you optimistic for the future with everything that you're dealing with nowadays?
Yeah, you know, I think that I always take that's a choice. Farming is inherently challenging. Every step of the turn, sometimes it feels like, you know, a new pest will crop up or a disease you thought you had under control acts up again. But I'm absolutely optimistic, and I continue to educate myself as to new practices that are more environmentally friendly. I mean, that's definitely our goal. We have weaned ourselves off of herbicide, which we feel good about. And every year we're making more changes so that we can positively contribute and try to be part of the solution and not so much part of the problem.
All of you are wonderful to speak with. And if you don't mind, I would like to squeeze in one more guest into this segment. Leighton Gunther is the director of Quail Hill Farm at the Peconic Land Trust. Leighton, how are you?
Doing great. How are you, Ron?
I'm fine, thank you. Have you been listening to the conversation?
I have.
And your thoughts about the changes that are taking place nowadays in terms of what's growing and what's not, and your feelings about whether or not it can be directly related to the climate crisis.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for having me on, and thank all of your guests, too, for sharing their experiences. I think those of us who live in and out our days connected to the landscape, you can't help but notice that there has been very tangible change. When I started farming 13 years ago, there were, you know, the errant fall storm. There was the errant fall storm here and there. And over the last 13 years, I would say, just to echo what most of your guests have already said, which is that the pattern isn't so much tied to Charles did say that there was a warming going on, but not so much tied to a general temperature shift in one way or another, but more so that the unpredictability of the weather is now the new normal that we are dealing with. And I think that you can say undoubtedly that it's related to climate change and the whole, especially where we are on the east end of Long Island on the South Fork, we often are catching the tail end of these larger tropical storms as they're tracking up the coast and as they blow out to ocean. So one huge benefit to farming close to the Atlantic Ocean is that it is this giant temperature sink, and that overall, compared to the rest of New York State, we get very mild, late, pretty cool springs and very mild, pretty warm autumns. But another trick to that proximity is that we are catching a lot of the larger storms as they track up the East Coast. So that does seem to be getting more severe year to year, but also the variables in terms of the lack of rainfall and, you know, chiefly that, actually, the lack of rain 8 to 10 weeks without rain in the height of our growing season is a huge challenge to our operations here. So
what I found very interesting that Charles said was that in the short term, and we all know that in the long term, this is not good for us, but in the short term, it's actually good for him.
Mm-hmm.
And how this affects all of us nowadays in certain ways is fascinating and in some ways terrifying, isn't it?
That's right. And just in response to that, I mean, if we were growing at Quail Hill Farm, say 1 to 2 high season summer crops that overall, you know, thrived in warm conditions, we'd probably be saying a similar thing. But we're growing over 550 varieties of vegetables and flowers and annual herbs and cut flowers, as I said. So the overall is that we want to try to increase stability, and any sort of increase in temperature means that some of our cool-loving crops, like our spring broccolis and cauliflowers and things like this, we can no longer grow with the warming temperatures.
Wait, now I have to take a break in 30 seconds. Can you just tell me before we break, did anything not grow this year?
Let's see. The biggest crop that we struggled with this season was actually our tomato crop. We had this very late, very cold spring, very, very wet, made it challenging for us to get into the fields in time. And once we were able to get our tomato crop in with the lack of rain that we had in July and August, that just delayed everything ripening, pushed everything back by about 3 weeks. I think most people you would talk to would also say that the ripening of things like native berries and so on and so forth were also delayed. So, our tomato crop really suffered from the weather conditions this year.
Wait, Leighton, hold on one moment. I just have to take one last break. We have a number of guests for the last segment of our program, and before I say goodbye to two of them, I just want to give them a chance to make some final comments. Nikki Auger is the vineyard manager and winemaker at Taylor Brook Winery in Woodstock, Connecticut. And Charles Massoud is the president and an owner of Pominock Vineyards and also of Palmer Vineyards. Those you may know, if you like wines, they're two of the oldest wineries on the North Fork of Long Island. Charles, are you optimistic for the future with everything that you've been going through and everything that you're seeing? Are you optimistic?
I'm a little bit of an older person, so for whatever is rest of my life, things are going to be good, but down the road, I worry about my grandchildren, what is going to be left to them. To put things in perspective, what's interesting is if you go back to 1920, we have a photo shoot here at the Historic Society where cars were driving to Connecticut over the frozen Long Island Sound. Imagine that.
Wow.
It seems in those days, temperatures in the winter used to drop to minus 25. The coldest temperature we recorded here was in 1983, December 29, 1983, we had minus 5 here. And ever since then, we've never been below zero. So within a century, we went from minus 25 to zero. We don't see those very cold temperatures anymore, which are beneficial because they kill the bugs in the winter. And if we don't get those cold temperatures anymore, we're going to see a surge of bugs that we had not seen in the past. So there are multiple facets to this warming trend, unfortunately.
Nikki Auger, final thoughts, please.
Yeah, you know, I also feel I feel optimistic about the future, mostly because we talk about it a lot, the other growers in Connecticut, and we're sharing resources, sharing ideas about how we can, as I was saying before, contribute rather than be a detriment to the environment, because we're out here every day and we see the impact of whether we're spraying and all of that. So I am hopeful, and continuing the conversation and continuing education and sharing best practices, I think, is going to be the key.
You know, if I may add one more
sure.
thing, on Long Island, we have developed what we call Long Island Sustainable Viticulture, which is a program where we make sure that we don't use pesticides more than we should, and whatever pesticide that we do use should be very low impact toxicity on the environment. And so that's a very important thing that we can do. And I think it's beginning to see more replications. More people are doing this around the country. But I'm glad that we already have this program in place for ourselves.
Charles Massoud, Nicky Ogier, I appreciate your time. You were both very nice, and please come back with us in the future.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. Charles Massoud, Nicky Ogier, and we still have on the line with us Carissa Battle and Leighton Gunther. Carissa, I have to move on because we're going to be speaking about, well, fish and the same thing that's happening to them in our region. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that, can I get some final thoughts from you, please?
Sure. To your question about optimism, I think, you know, in some ways it's hard to be optimistic knowing that we will lose species and some species will not adapt. Some will. Some, like grapes, may benefit, but there will be some that don't. But the aspect that is so inspiring and compelling in this particular field of phenology is that it's a field that empowers people to be on the front lines of science research, regardless of background or demographics. So really anybody can be an observer. So if you are your own backyard garden, if you have one red maple tree on your property, you can be part of this growing network of observers that are forming globally at a rapid rate. And they are all the eyes on the ground in this field, because there aren't enough scientists to be tracking what's happening to every species. This movement is really helping people to just have the tools to be more connected and to have more of a sense of place where they live and work. And they can do that while also collecting valuable data. And that's just an incredibly inspiring prospect to me.
Carissa Battle is an ecologist and the founding director of the Community Greenways Collaborative. Carissa, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Be well. And Leighton Gunther is with us. Leighton, before we let you go, as the director of Quail Hill Farm at the Peconic Land Trust, if someone is listening to the program right now, and they're saying, okay, I'm hearing all these things. How do I plan for next year? How do I plan for the next growing season? What should I be doing? Do you have any advice?
Well, I think the first thing that I would say is that in our region, most of your listeners are sitting probably within a stone's throw of a very rich agricultural community. So a lot of growers in our region on the east end of Long Island, who have been growing out here for, you know, decades, a generation or more. When I think about planning for next year, and when I think about, you know, staring down the pipeline of another growing season with climate uncertainty and all of the perils of mixed vegetable farming, one thing that I like to do is I just plan. I just sit out, do a lot of writing, and I also like to go out into the community of farmers that surrounds me and talk to other people. You know, despite what I think, farming brings a lot of blessings into my life. One being that it really connects me to the earth, and it also can make me very focused on a singular piece of land. And it's amazing what people just down the road, some of our fellow farmers in Amagansett at Balsam Farms or Amber Waves Farm here, experience, and just the variabilities that people are tackling and the problems that people have to solve are many and varied. And I think that farmers are as slow as we are to change at times, we're also very innovative, and I have learned untold amounts from just communing with them. So that is what I would encourage your listeners to do, is just go out into your agricultural community and talk to other people who are living on land and see how other folks are strategizing and building up resiliency in the face of this kind of climate uncertainty.
Great advice. Leighton Gunther, the director of Quail Hill Farm at the Peconic Land Trust. Leighton, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ron.
Now, in our final segment, with our final few minutes here, since we've been talking about what's happening nowadays, terra firma, let's spend a few minutes finding out what's happening in our waters. Matthew McKenzie is Associate Professor of History at the University of Connecticut at UConn, focusing on marine environmental history, and he's a Connecticut obligatory delegate for the New England Fisheries. Professor McKenzie, how are you, sir?
I'm well.
And Professor Justin Davis is Assistant Director of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection Marine Fisheries Program. And Professor Davis, welcome to you, sir.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So we've been talking a lot in this program about how climate change is impacting the growing patterns above ground, if you will. Tell us how it's impacting the fishing industry. Professor McKenzie, can I start with you, please?
Sure, yeah. Climate change is something that is, I think in a simple statement, it's straining a marine ecosystem that's already under a lot of strain. Our region has historically seen booms and busts in fish stock populations driven by, most recently by overfishing, but we're starting to see species migrations moving in. We're seeing shifting distributions of plankton, which affects the animals that prey further up the marine ecosystem. And it's getting in the way of our efforts to try to rebuild some critical stocks in this region. We've had some successes, but we have not been able to get, for example, Georgia's Bay cod or Gulf of Maine cod to rebound at all. And it continues to cause a lot of worries. Yellowtail flounder is also in really bad shape. Other flounders are in bad shape. And most recently, we've had a collapse of probably one of the most important species in the region, Atlantic sea herring. And that's basically the forage for all the other fish that we're really interested in, whether it's ground fish like cod and haddock or striped bass or other species that are more more the target of recreational anglers rather than commercial species. So it's throwing a lot of strain on the region's marine resources and the fishermen working in it.
Professor Davis, your take, please.
Yeah, so I would echo a lot of what Matt just said. Certainly in Long Island Sound, we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in the fish and invertebrate community in the Sound over the last couple decades due to climate change. Some of our sort of classic cold water species that we used to have in Long Island Sound that supported very important fisheries like the winter flounder or American lobster have become very scarce, and at the same time, more warm water species that typically were more common down in the mid-Atlantic states or the southern states have now become increasingly abundant here in Long Island Sound, like scup and black sea bass and summer flounder. And so those changes, as you can imagine, have produced sort of big changes in the fishing activity that we have here in the Sound. And one of the challenges that we've been facing is that the interstate fisheries management bodies, so there's these councils, you mentioned the New England Council, with which Dr. McKenzie sits on, and I sit on the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. These interstate bodies manage these species because they migrate up and down the coast, and they get to determine how many fish from each state get to be taken by the fishermen. And so in a lot of cases, we're dealing with allocation of these fish that's very outdated. They made decisions 20 or 30 years ago about how many, for instance, black sea bass each state should be able to harvest. And in that time period, those fish have moved and live up north much more than they used to, but sort of the management, the quota allocations haven't kept up with that. So it's created some challenges for our fishing community. There's some new opportunities out there that we haven't been able to take full advantage of.
Professor Davis, can I get you to respond to an email that we got in earlier today? And it comes from Karen Rivara, who's with Arrows Cultured Oyster Company. And this is what she wrote. She said, I would say that the oyster growth this year was extraordinarily fast. Some of my customers are already harvesting oysters from this year's seed.
So I wouldn't claim to be an expert on shellfish or oyster aquaculture, but I would not be surprised if warmer water temperatures might produce increased growth rates for shellfish. And certainly it might also have something to do with food availability. You know, oysters and most shellfish are filter feeders. They're filtering plankton out of the water column. If this was a particularly good year for plankton growth, it might have translated into really good growth for oysters. And of course, that's one of those things that we're always thinking about as scientists assessing what's going on out there in the environment, is that the environment is never constant. There's always changes from year to year, and we're always trying to tease out what are the bigger long-term changes that are happening gradually, teasing that out from sort of the year-to-year changes we see. So that's one of the real challenges when we assess what's going on out there in the marine environment.
Professor McKenzie, what are you hearing from those in the fishing industry? I mean, what's this doing to their bottom line?
They're nervous. I just returned from Gloucester this afternoon for a three-day hearing. And the effects of climate change on top of, again, all the other problems that we were wrestling with before is really starting to show up in our stock assessment models, which are not, some of them aren't doing as well as we'd like them to do from a sort of diagnostic perspective. And we've had to, you know, ratchet down on these quotas because the fish aren't showing up. And now there are some circumstances in that might not be necessarily tied to climate change, and we're working on those. But you know, for ground fishermen, certainly north of Cape Cod, it's dire times, and they are shifting onto other species that they have permits for. We've seen some instances where we've got people who are theoretically ground fishermen, but most of their income is coming from other species that, again, they're harvesting legally, but it wasn't what they're rigged up to do. And that adaptation, you know, historically southern New England has always been a very flexible and adaptive fleet. We, you know, Point Judith guys used to shift gear all the time based upon whatever was migrating up the shoreline at any given time of year. But because of the collapse in a number of critical species in New England beginning about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we've had to put in limited access programs, and that reduces fishing fleets' abilities to shift from one gear to another in order to take advantage of the new opportunities, for example, that the ones that Dr. Lawson just mentioned. So it's putting a strain on them, and combined with, I don't know if you've heard about the Carlos Rafael case, you know, some people are being pushed to do things that aren't legal, and it's not a happy time in the groundfish fishery. That said, it's important to note that the scallop fishery seems to be doing okay, but there's some worrying signs there, too, that aren't dire by any stretch right now, but we're watching them, and we've got some concern about them if they continue on. So, you know, if we can think about New England fishing as a single entity, which it's not, it's a very varied industry with lots of different levels of capitalization, profit margins, operational practices, things like that. But as a whole, most of the people outside the scallop fleet and the lobster fleet are worried.
Professor Davis, with the minute that I have left, and I hate to put you on the spot, and I promise to get both of you back on in the future, and we'll have a nice long talk. What should Connecticut do right away? What should New York do right away to try and ensure the health of the fishing industry and the quality of what's in our waters nowadays?
So I think our two states are already doing a lot of good when it comes to ensuring the quality of the water and the natural resources in Long Island Sound. We've made huge advancements in wastewater treatment over the last couple decades. We've done a great job of doing public education and outreach about good land management practices that can sort of impact what ends up flowing into Long Island Sound. So I think we're doing a lot of good there. When it comes to trying to essentially deal with the challenges that climate change is posing for the fisheries management process, I think the best thing that Connecticut and New York and other regional states can do is really try to continue to engage with those groups like the New England Management Council, the Atlantic States Commission, and try to update the way that we're managing fisheries to reflect the big changes we're seeing in fish populations off our coast. Essentially, the administrative management side of things is not keeping pace with what's happening out there with the environment, and it's causing a lot of problems for our fishing industry.
Professor Justin Davis is Assistant Director of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, the Marine Fisheries Program, and Matthew McKenzie is the Associate Professor of History at UConn, focusing on marine environmental history, and he's also a Connecticut Obligatory Delegate for the New England Fisheries. Gentlemen, thank you. I appreciate your time and expertise. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You bet. My pleasure.
That's going to do it for our show today. Sabrina Garone is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak, and thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.